Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Barton Gellman. Bart is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He currently serves as a senior advisor at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. Previously, he was a staff writer at The Atlantic and The Washington Post. He's the author of Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State, as well as Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency, for which he won the Los Angeles Times Book Award. Anyway, Bart and I talk mostly about election integrity and the safeguarding of American democracy. We discuss the war games he's run to test our response to an authoritarian president, the prospect of such a president using federal troops against American citizens, the difference between laws and norms, state powers to resist the federal government, voter identification and election integrity, political control over election certifications, the Bush-Gore election, the Electoral Count Reform Act, the prospect of public unrest after the November election, the significance of January 6th, George Soros, the good people on both sides calumny against Trump, what will happen to Trump and Trumpism if Harris wins in November, the presidential debate between Harris and Trump, the authoritarian potential of a second Trump term, Project 2025, and other topics. Just one note, we recorded this conversation before the second attempt on Trump's life. So if there's any place where it seems like we should have discussed that and didn't, that's why. And now I bring you Barton Gellman. I am here with Barton Gellman. Bart, thanks for joining me again.
Pleasure to be here.
So you've been busy since we last spoke. When I last spoke to you, you were a mere Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for The Atlantic, but now you have moved on to become a man of action, purpose toward protecting our democracy. What are you up to? You've left The Atlantic, and what are you now doing?
I am in the office of the president of the Brennan Center for Justice, which is based in New York and has a big presence in Washington. It's a think tank, a public policy advocate. It does litigation and so forth. And the main purpose is to protect democracy and civil rights. I was at The Atlantic for about 4 years, and I spent most of my time writing about how there were existential dangers to democracy. I'd done a piece 2 months before the 2020 election predicting that it could be a disaster if Donald Trump lost the election and refused to concede defeat. And I outlined many ways that might happen. And I would have wished that to be wrong, but it didn't prove so. I finally got tired of writing about how we're at this kind of generational challenge to democracy and decided to stop saying, look over there, it looks really bad over there, and to kind of step in, step off the sidelines and try to do something about it. So to get to your question, my first big project at the Brennan Center was to run something we called the Democracy Futures Project, which was a series of five tabletop exercises, or you could call them war games, in which we had about 175 in all former officials and leaders of civil society. We had a couple of governors, we had a couple of cabinet members, all retired, a senator, a couple of members of Congress, judge, generals, and so forth, coming in to war game what would happen if an authoritarian president were elected and pro-democracy advocates, kind of across a broad range of government and society, tried to restrain that president. And instead of just saying, well, he may try to do this and then we would just do that, we gamed out how it would actually work with an iteration through multiple rounds of the game so that the red president who had run on Trump's agenda could respond to pro-democracy moves to try to stop him, and they could respond to his responses.
Mm. And how are these games conducted? I mean, so the person who plays the role of the president in this case Is it up to him or her just to be as bad as they want to be? I mean, is it just an exercise in extemporaneous gameplay and fiction making, or are there parameters in advance that are ironed out, you know, precisely, and they're basically just following some kind of template in response to the various moves that are being made against them?
Well, first of all, bad as they want to be could be a good band name.
Mm-hmm.
We had two of the five games were basically that. We called them Everything Everywhere All at Once games. And the person playing the president was supposed to be modeling his or her behavior on Trump's declared agenda and the agenda of his closest allies. For example, Project 2025 is, you know, kind of written by over 100 former Trump administration officials.
Yeah, it's amazing. Trump knows nothing about it.
He's never met these people.
He's got no association with him whatsoever.
Yeah. I think 22 of its chapters were authored by his former senior people. Mm. So we considered that fair game for guidance of what the president would do in office. So in those, the president did a lot of things all at once and tended to overwhelm the blue or the pro-democracy team by doing that with all the resources of the federal government. Three of the games we did with a narrower policy focus. And I should just mention here that none of the games modeled any kind of behavior that falls within the ordinary range of policy and political disputes. So we weren't testing what happens if he cuts taxes or pulls out of a climate accord again, or even an issue like abortion. We were testing only things that Trump has said he wants to do that would be threats to democracy and the institutions that uphold the rule of law.
Like what specifically?
Like, for example, use arms of the federal government to go after your enemies. So prosecute them, the Department of Justice, or bring antitrust actions against Amazon because you don't like what Jeff Bezos is doing with the Washington Post, which he's also the owner of, or sending the IRS to challenge the tax exemptions of nonprofits, like the Brennan Center, for that matter, because they're advocating things that he doesn't like, among many examples. Mm.
Well, what about using federal troops or the military to quell protests or round up undocumented workers or that sort of thing?
Well, those actually were the other two games. Mm. One of them was about the domestic use of military power, military force, to break up anti-Trump demonstrations on the grounds that they consisted of insurrections and riots and were threats to the rule of law that local and state authorities could not handle, even though actually the mayors and governors involved in those scenarios said they needed no federal help. That was one.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was mass expulsion of migrants, sending federal law enforcement forces into cities all around the country to make mass arrests, to send migrants to detention facilities and to expel them back to their countries of origin, or just expel them back to Mexico, whether or not they came from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were testing was, what could anybody do about that? And the answer wasn't always a happy one. I mean, for example, we had a former governor, we did these exercises under the Chatham House rule, so we don't name participants unless they gave their consent. But in this case, Christy Todd Whitman, the former Republican governor of New Jersey, did give her consent. So I can say that she was one of the players, and she was looking for a way to prevent the president from using his authority to federalize the National Guard in her state. And one of the interesting things that emerged from this was that governors don't actually know where their power ends and the president's power begins, because we haven't, as far as I know, ever had a case in which the president federalized the guard against the will of the governor of that state. Ordinarily, it's the governor who requests that the president do so.
I thought there was nothing like that that happened during desegregation in the South. I mean, my history is a little wonky here, but just when the forcible integration of whatever that college was in Alabama or Mississippi, or forgive my the vagaries here, but didn't JFK have to bring in the National Guard to? I mean, I am just assuming it was over the protest of the governor, but maybe that's not the case.
Well, I am also not an expert historian on that subject. It's true that the president did send the guard. I'm not even sure it was JFK, but you may be right.
Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, it was JFK definitely was the president for, I mean, perhaps there are other episodes that I'm not thinking of, but for one of these, yeah, it was JFK was calling the shots.
What I understood is that the governor did not try to prevent the federalization of the guard. Mm-hmm. In that instance,
I think there was definitely somebody did. It was probably the mayor who was against it, and then the governor was probably acquiescing to the president. So, yeah. So it wasn't. It probably wasn't opposition between a governor and a president in that case.
Well, it's just not every day that you have a state adjutant general who is the senior commanding officer of the state guard who gets conflicting orders from the president of the United States and from the governor of that state, and turns out that governors don't happen to have in their back pocket a clear understanding of where the boundaries are. And that's, I mean, it's one of the takeaways from our exercise is that governors and state attorneys general and state legislatures and potentially mayors are independent sources of authority who can offer some protection against an authoritarian abusing the powers of the federal government, but they need to actually study up on what the authorities are and what the boundaries of their authorities are.
Right. But that's assuming that these governors and state officials are not part of the personality cult that is rooting for the aspiring authoritarian to wield as much power as he wants.
Yes.
So when you play these games, are there people on the side of the autocrat or aspiring autocrat too, or was everyone trying to resist the president?
No, we gave the president a full cabinet and executive agencies, and there were also supportive governors. Mm. There were supportive judges. The military was considered neutral, and in some cases did resist orders that it considered to be unlawful, or at least tried to slow things down to get clarity on what a lawful mission might be. But you know, one of the interesting things about this exercise, we had Republicans and Democrats, we had conservatives and liberals. We really did have a pretty broad ideological spectrum, people who disagreed on a lot of things. But we didn't have any, you know, sort of strong current Trump supporters. We had former officials who served under Trump. But everyone in the room in real life was a pro-Democrat with small d. But it was remarkable how much fun they had playing an autocrat. They really delved into the part, and there was something about the transgressiveness of ordering the prosecution of your political enemies. They were coming up with ideas, some of which we're not even going to publish because they were ideas we don't think Trump has had
they're
yet.
They're so diabolical. Yeah. Well, I can imagine. As a creative exercise, it's got to be a ton of fun playing the bad guy.
I think it's why they say actors in Hollywood enjoy those villainous parts more than the kind of, I don't know, there's something very ordinary about playing someone with good intentions. In any case, these folks, you know, including people who are well-known critics of Trump or, you know, quit his administration in outrage, certainly played the role with relish.
So I think we like to imagine that we have a system that is so good that it doesn't require good people to run it, right? That it should be impervious to the intrusion of a malicious, narcissistic jerk who just wants to enrich himself and hold on to power. But I think, I mean, one lesson I drew from the Trump years was that where we thought we had laws to cover all of these contingencies, we, in many, many cases, all too many cases, we only had norms, right? And norms on some level were, you know, more flexible than and more important than laws, but because they're not laws, when somebody blows right past them, you're left with not much you can do. Is that too cynical and paranoid a lesson to have drawn from Trump's presidency, or do you agree with that assessment?
You know, I think we got mixed results from the Trump administration in terms of the value of having sort of right-thinking people who believed in fulfilling their duty to follow the law and to follow longstanding ethical rules and to follow the governing norms that were consensus norms between the parties. There were times when people like that were absolutely critical to stopping bad things from happening. So that's why you had all these leaks from the people around Trump during his presidency. And that way you found out, for example, that, you know, his Treasury Secretary had removed a document from his desk before Trump could see it and sign it because it was so crazy and hadn't gone through the usual governing processes. And in the effort to overthrow the 2020 election, there were people at kind of even not terribly senior levels who drew a line and said, I won't do that, even though I'm a Republican, and prevented the overthrow. I mean, there's a guy whose name I can't recall, but I wish I could because he deserves celebration. It was Vander something, a guy on the Michigan State Board of Elections. Mm. And the way the board works is it had, I think it was 3-3. It had an equal number of Republicans and Democrats on it. And if all of the Republicans had refused to certify the election, as Trump was asking them to do, then Michigan's electoral votes would be in controversy. It might be arguable in courts or in Congress that the electoral votes had not been cast, although that probably wouldn't have worked. But this one Republican on the board, not a very senior guy, some guy in his 30s, who did this as literally a part-time gig, said, I'm not going to refuse to certify the election. The votes have all been counted and double-checked, and everything is in order, and I'm going to vote to certify. And for that reason, Michigan was taken out of the unknown category, and the man who won it, Joe Biden, got those votes. You had the same thing with the elected Secretary of State in Georgia, who's better known, Brad Raffensperger, and more junior people in the state secretariat who refused Trump's request to, quote unquote, find 11,780 votes that could be flipped so that he would win the state of Georgia. So you did have these people who I think were real heroes and upheld the law, but you also found out, as you say, that a lot of the stuff that we don't want presidents to do because it would be a huge abuse of power, there's actually no law against it. And Trump has a kind of genius for finding stuff where nobody ever wrote down, you can't do that. I mean, you know, for example, if he had wanted to put a giant banner over the White House to advertise, you know, Trump goods for sale, there's nothing written down anywhere that says you can't do that. Mm-hmm.
This might be one of those ideas you don't want to leak out lest he get it into his head. Leave it to him to sell Trump steaks and other crap from the facade of the White House. So what did you find after these games were run? What was the punchline with respect to what the system could do to contain the overreach of a rogue president?
Well, the unhappy conclusion was that the blue team seldom found a way to stop the autocrat in his tracks. They seldom found, you know, the one weird trick that lets you cage him up and prevent him from abusing his power. But we did find things that could delay or deflect or diminish the damage of authoritarian acts. So one thing I've mentioned already, which is that if you have a governor or a state attorney general who believes in the rule of law and is willing to resist an overreach of federal executive power, those people have a lot of power and need to be doing their homework now, so they're not in the middle of an episode and unaware of what they can and can't do. And there are a bunch of questions that may not actually be settled law that they need to be ready to take position on. Like, are there any limits you can impose on, you know, someone from the Bureau of Prisons or from DHS or from a militia that the authoritarian president has deputized to enforce federal law and comes into your city or your state and starts rounding people up? Can you impose any limits on how they exercise police powers in your state? Does state law or the state or do the state courts have the power to limit those things? What would happen if you refused a federal demand for state data that might help them find migrants who they're looking to expel and so on? I mean, they just need to do a kind of broad-reaching sweep of their legal and operational authorities.
I have to think that there is an army of Democratic and never Trump lawyers who are at work on this and have been at work on this for some time to try to prepare our democracy for a coming stress test in reality should Trump get four more years to take a crack at it. Is that too hopeful a notion? Is that, what are all the lawyers doing who are equally worried about this?
Well, you know, it's sort of a yes and no. I'll tell you a story from the beginning of 2024. I was thinking about making this career change, and I called up Michael Waldman, who's the president of the Brennan Center, and said, you know, do you have a place for me there? And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to protect the November election, and I'd like to do planning for what happens if Trump wins and tries to carry out his authoritarian agenda. And he told me, we're doing a lot of the one already, and we're not doing a lot of the other. And that's why I started where I started. Now, since then, there are a lot of organizations and people in the kind of democracy and rule of law space who are thinking and planning ahead for how you would restrain an authoritarian president. They're trying to do a lot of things at once. They're trying to protect, for example, the integrity of the November election. They're doing planning for what happens if a Democrat wins or even if there's a Democratic trifecta. I mean, the Brennan Center, for example, would put huge priority on passing the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Improvement Act. And so there are people doing that kind of planning. And for a while, there was a time when people just didn't really want to think too much about things going wrong after the inauguration of the new president in 25. I think that's changed quite a bit in recent months, but there's plenty more work to be done.
Okay, well, let's take it from the top here. I'd like to talk about the November election and the various outcomes that we might expect. But before we do, is there any sympathetic construal we might give to the right-wing slash populist slash Trumpist concerns about the integrity of our elections? I mean, so you've got a lot of people out there that have come to the Trump circus from, you know, Trump himself and Elon Musk on down, who are making noises about that seem to signal the legitimacy of concerns about election integrity. We should have paper ballots. You know, the computers can be hacked. There are people who are, you know, who are voting who shouldn't vote. You know, and the Democrats want to bring in lots of non-citizens to vote effectively, and therefore voter ID laws are just make abundant sense. I mean, just take a voter ID. What is wrong with passing a voter ID law? I mean, we need ID for so many things that are far more trivial than voting. Why does anyone resist the need to have proper identification when you go to vote?
Well, the question is, what's proper identification? How are the standards set and for what purpose? And I'm going to give a very broad answer to your meta question here. It is almost universally the case that when people talk about the need to protect election integrity as a political issue, they are trying to prevent people from voting who are not on their side. Election integrity, the idea that they have to stop an election from being stolen, premised on the idea that the 2020 election was stolen, which is nonsense, are almost universally proposed by people who are, in fact, trying to steal the next election. So let's come back to voter ID. The big idea on the table right now from the Speaker of the House, who is trying to attach it to funding the federal government and threatening to shut down the government if it's not attached, is called the SAVE Act. And it is ostensibly to stop non-citizens from voting. So here's what's really going on. First of all, non-citizens are not voting. They claim, the proponents of this bill claim, that there are millions of non-citizens being shipped in to vote for Democrats. They can't name millions or thousands or hundreds or even dozens of occasions on which a non-citizen has ever voted in a U.S. election. They have completely
The truth is, we have the opposite problem. We have citizens who can't be bothered to vote, right? I mean, it's the idea that voting is such an attractive thing to do that even non-citizens by the millions would want to do it is just patently ridiculous.
Well, right. So we have citizens who can't be bothered to vote. That's true. And it would be better if we had a democratic culture, small d democratic culture in this country, in which more people wanted to vote, wanted to participate, and believed that there was something in it for them, that they could have some impact on the way our government is run and the way society functions and some way to improve their own lives by participating. That's one thing. But it's also true that citizens who do have the right to vote are prevented from voting by some of the things they want. So the proposal in the SAVE Act, in order to solve a non-existent problem of non-citizens voting, is that you should have to have be able to present a birth certificate or a passport in order to vote. So there's good data that shows that poor people and racial minorities are disproportionately unable to present documents like that. I mean, they've never traveled abroad. They don't have a passport. How many people can actually put hands on their own birth certificates? And so you're going to prevent some rich Republicans from voting if they can't find their birth certificate. But the point of it is to remove from the voting rolls a lot of people who the Republicans think are going to vote for Democrats. And so by trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, they're creating a new one of disenfranchisement, of preventing people from voting. And, you know, in litigation and in hundreds of statutory changes around the country, laws passed by state Republican legislatures, laws proposed by others, they are, in every case, every's a big word, I'll say virtually every case, they are designed to reduce the number of people voting, to take people off of voter rolls. And it's grotesque, and it's fundamentally sort of undemocratic, anti-democratic behavior.
Yeah, I guess my intuition here is a little, I guess it cuts across this problem, you know, what I imagine is certainly a nonpartisan way, but I just feel like given that this keeps coming up, and there is so much that we do require identification for in our society. I mean, to get on an airplane, you need identification now, right? So this is, you know, that's got to pose a problem for all the people who can't figure out how to get ID who want to fly, right? So the question is there a way to solve this problem? I mean, we're not going to solve it in advance of November's election, but for future elections, it just seems that we should figure out how to get people the identification they need to vote and remove this as this perennial object of partisan gamesmanship, so that people can vote with the ID that we have agreed on is sufficient for the situation.
No, so I mean, in every state, in every county, in every jurisdiction, you do have to present local election officials with sufficient evidence that identifies you as a person who lives in the district and is entitled to vote. Sometimes it's a utility bill. Sometimes it's some other form of photo ID. And for example, in Texas, not so many years ago, the Republican state legislature imposed an ID requirement in which a university ID with photo would not count to allow you to vote because college students
might not be citizens. Yeah.
Well, college students are are less likely to vote Republican.
Right.
But they did allow a gun license, which doesn't even have a photograph on it, to count.
That's genuinely funny. Yeah. That is something that would have produced a laugh in one of your war games had it been produced for that purpose.
Yeah.
So,
well, there are a lot of things that, you know, you either laugh or cry when you see it. But, I mean, you know, the latest thing that's happening now in the election integrity front, quote unquote, is you have a move in multiple states, including several swing states around the country, most kind of paradigmatically in Georgia, to impose political control over certification of election results. So that's a new legislative and litigation related front in this war. You have a member there was a member of the elections board for one of the counties in Georgia, a woman named Adams, who refused to certify the results of a primary election in 2022 and demanded to be given the power to investigate. Mm-hmm. This is someone who was a long-time election denier, someone who was propounding the lie that the 2020 election had been stolen from Trump, and she wanted the power to command the production of all this data from election officials, sensitive data that's kept private for a reason, and refused to certify. Then the governor appointed three Republicans to the five-person state election board who passed a new rule for elections in Georgia that enabled the Republican administrators of elections in the counties to refuse to certify and to investigate instead. Now, certification has always been a kind of a ministerial function. There's lots of good law from around the country and from that's more than 100 years old that election officials don't have the power to investigate elections. If there's a controversy over whether there was foul play in an election, it goes to the courts, mm-hmm. where they have standards and rules of evidence. And in 2020, ruled 60 some times that there was no evidence that the election had been stolen. But they want that function now to be exercised by partisan officials on election boards. And that offers a lot of opportunities for mischief and chaos and at least delaying the outcome of an election and potentially to overturn the vote of the people and say that the loser actually won.
Yeah, so that's another level at which the integrity of an election can be attacked. And again, I have to think that there are Democratic lawyers who've been all over this for quite some time. I mean, from the top down, we've got Kamala Harris and her husband, both of whom are attorneys, right? I mean, is it conceivable that the Democrats are not sufficiently alert to Republican Trumpist machinations in trying to put their true believers into positions of authority when it comes time to count votes?
The pro-democracy forces are very much alive to this problem and very much engaged in it. And the Brennan Center, where I work, is a tax-exempt, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, but it believes in the right to vote. And anywhere that someone is trying to throw people off voter rolls for insufficient reason or is trying to insert a new political level of voter certification, the Brennan Center and lots of its allies are all over that. They get involved in lobbying for or against state legislation. They've filed amicus briefs in several cases challenging these new laws. And these laws are very much under partisan debate around the country. So in Wisconsin, where the state legislature is heavily Republican and gerrymandered to remain so, the Democratic governor has vetoed a number of these changes. So there are laws that would have been in place by now in Wisconsin to politicize the vote count, but for the fact that Tony Evers vetoed those. But there are other states, even with Democratic governors, where the Republicans have a veto-proof majority and are passing these statutes, and they're under litigation now, even as we speak.
So what do you expect in November? So, I mean, there's obviously there are two outcomes. Kamala Harris could win or Donald Trump could win. I guess there are really four outcomes. I mean, I either could win quite narrowly, which is what I think we expect, but I guess things change if either wins in a landslide. I mean, let's just linger on that possibility for a second. Wouldn't a landslide victory obviate some of the concerns we're going to raise here? I mean, just if Kamala Harris wins, 400 electoral votes, do the lingering disputes over whether the election was run properly, the endless, protests and riots we might be worried about, does the risk of all that get radically diminished, I guess, in either direction if there's a landslide for one of the candidates?
Oh, I think absolutely you're right about that. In fact, there's an inside joke among election administrators that there's something that they facetiously call the election administrator's prayer is, Lord, let there be a landslide.
Right.
Because then all the little controversies about whether this ballot drop box was compromised by the fact that the streetlight went out for half an hour, that stuff just stops mattering. And the outcome is clear. But I'm no political pundit. I covered politics for a lot of years as a journalist, and I'm involved in controversies about politics now at the Brennan Center. But I think the consensus view is this election will be decided by a very small number of voters in a very small number of states.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the tipping point state is going to be Pennsylvania or Wisconsin, maybe Michigan, maybe North Carolina. And if you look at the polls in those states, they're either dead even or very close to the margin of error in terms of who's ahead. So you could very easily expect that the winning margin is going to be in the tens of thousands of votes. It could even be smaller than that, as it was in Florida in 2000.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about those possibilities. So what would you expect in the case of a narrow Harris victory versus a narrow Trump victory? I mean, it's just in terms of, is there any kind of symmetry here? I mean, I guess it's possible to expect that in a close victory, either way, you have half the country possibly poised to not accept the results of the election, right? I think this is obviously a worse problem over in Trumpistan, given that this conspiracy thinking about all this has been consciously engineered for now the better part of a decade. But do you think is there anything like an equivalent level of paranoia, skepticism, conspiracy thinking that could allow for just a breakdown in a fundamental trust in the electoral process, regardless of the outcome?
I do actually think that there is some symmetry in the sense that there will be some Democrats, some influential Democrats, and a substantial number of Democratic voters who challenge the outcome if Harris loses, who will attempt to block certification in some state, who will take other steps to say that there was cheating or that the result isn't legitimate, but they will not be a majority of the party. They will not be the party's top leaders. And most importantly, Kamala Harris, like every other candidate in the history of the presidency, save one, if she loses, she will concede defeat. That will take the wind out of the sails of the people who want her to keep on fighting. So, I mean, for example, people like to say that in 2000, in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court actually decided the outcome of the election and ended the controversy. And that's true and not true. So the Supreme Court did say the count should stop in Florida, and the count that was being challenged, which had Bush ahead by some tiny number of votes, should stand as the outcome. But Al Gore still had weapons in his arsenal that he could have used to continue to fight to challenge that result. For example, he was the sitting vice president and was going to preside over the January 6th count of the electoral votes.
He could have been his own Congress. Mike Pence. Yeah.
He could have been the Mike Pence who Trump wanted instead of the Mike Pence he got. But he had other means of challenging it. In fact, his campaign manager, I believe it was preparing an alternate slate of electors in Florida who would claim to be the valid electors in Florida who cast their votes for Gore. And Al Gore personally stopped that. And the day after the Supreme Court ruled, he came out and gave the usual gracious speech that said, I accept the Supreme Court's ruling. I accept that I have lost this election. I wish the best for our new president. And the cause will go on and the fight will continue and we'll get him next time. Every losing candidate ever in the history of the United States has done that except for Donald Trump. So we could expect that Kamala Harris would do that if she lost and that Trump would not do that. And this time, instead of trying to make it up as they go along, the people behind him have done a lot of advanced preparation to get ready to overturn a result in which he doesn't win. So the legal theories are better thought through. The legal efforts are better funded. They have a lot of state legislatures on their side. Trump is, as he always has, working to undermine the legitimacy of the election ahead of time and to say that either he's going to win or the election will have been rigged. So we can expect that it will be a matter of kind of party consensus and of major unified efforts to overturn the results if Trump loses. And I believe there will be Democrats who try to overturn the results if Harris loses, but she won't be among them, and the effort will stall out because of that.
Well, I would point out, I would imagine others have pointed this out, that Harris will be the vice president who will have to certify the results of this election. I can't imagine Trump and his enablers would want Harris this time around to behave the way they wanted Pence to behave last time around. I mean, you know, that point of hypocrisies will be completely lost on them. But just the fact that there are these weird loopholes that seem to be blocked only by norms and not by clear laws. I mean, like, what is this alternate slate of electors business that anyway, like, why is this something that we even need to talk about?
Well, we have a little less to talk about now than we did in 2020 on that front, because Congress managed to pass really only one major reform after the debacle in 2020 among the sort of 30-some that have been identified by experts to try to reduce the chance that an election could be overturned. They did pass the Electoral Count Reform Act, and that now resolves some of the ambiguities in the previously valid Electoral Count Act, which was it sort of comically badly drafted, and it had the longest, possibly the longest run-on sentence in the U.S. Code, and was very, very difficult to parse.
So they should bring Judith Butler in here to help. She could produce a longer run-on sentence.
Yes, well, I'm sure that someone could at a contest. But, you know, I did spend some hours trying to read it for that piece I wrote in 2020, and boy, was it a mess. It's now clear, for example, that it's the governor of the state who certifies the vote, and the governor's version of who the state's electors are is the one that will presumptively govern if there's more than one slate of electors passed to Congress and to the National Archives, which is how it's done. It's transmitted by each state to the National Archives and to Congress.
But does this leave us vulnerable to the QAnon inflected whims of a deranged governor?
It might. And we just have to hope that we don't have that governor in a battleground state. And I don't think we do. I mean, honestly, if it were left to, well, you know what? I think I'm not going to say that because I am now not as free with my own opinion as I was before I joined a tax-exempt mm-hmm. organization. Mm-hmm. But there are governors in this country who you could imagine putting their thumb on the scale to that extent of actually saying that whoever won the vote in their state had really lost and the loser had really won and send the wrong electors to Congress. But I'm looking at the battleground states. First of all, some of the governors of those states, like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, yeah. are Democrats. And in others, like Georgia, you have a governor who has already demonstrated a willingness to defy Trump's demands yeah. that they overturn the result in their state.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's walk further through this. So in a narrow victory for either candidate, you imagine challenges, but how worried are you about public unrest on either side of an election, down either branch of this possibility tree?
You know, I do worry about it. I mean, there's certain to be strong public demonstrations of discontent no matter who wins the election, and there will be angry crowds. It is also true, if you study the research that's been done into domestic violent extremism in this country, the FBI has said that the extreme right and extreme nationalist forces and nationalist religious forces are the most significant threat of organized violence in this country. And there's a guy named Robert Pape, whose research I admire, works out of University of Chicago, who has done some of the pioneering analysis on this. And what he found was that there are tens of millions of people in this country, based on representative opinion polls, who believe both that right now Joe Biden is an illegitimate president, that the election was stolen from Trump, and that violence is justified to set things right. And so, you have Trump using language like bloodbath and bloody, and you have, Tommy Tuberville came out in the last day or two saying that if they don't pass this legislation against non-citizen voting, then the country won't stand for it and bad things are going to happen. There's a lot of talk that goes right up to the edge of calling for violence. And I think the way Robert Pape at Chicago talks about it, you have a lot of dry tinder out there prepared for violence. And what it's going to take is a spark. And the day that Trump comes out, if he does, and says, this election was stolen, you've got to use your Second Amendment rights and take to the streets and stop this from happening. If he gives anything like an unambiguous call to arms, there are a lot of people who would respond to that.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where you wonder if there's daylight between what people claim to believe and what they actually believe, because you have a lot of people who claim to believe that the 2020 election was stolen, that their country has been stolen from them, that Joe Biden is totally illegitimate. And, these are the kinds of people who in their own minds have armed themselves against just such an eventuality and such a usurpation of the Constitution and American democracy. And yet there hasn't been that kind of violence, right? There hasn't been even much in the way of real protest. There's just this sort of seething online. And, I'm sure there are militias traipsing around the woods at this very moment, preparing for for doomsday. But still, what we haven't seen is Timothy McVeigh-style terrorism or anything like an organized response to this claim, which if sincerely believed, you would think This is go time for the Patriots.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's an expression, you know, sort of in the online forums, you know, storm front for the Nazis and, you know, the darker, you know, sort of subreddits and 4chans and elsewhere, people talking about the need for revolution, the need, you know, it's 1776 again, and the big talkers there are called keyboard warriors. And they say all this stuff, but they're not, in fact, you know, sort of going out and organizing an armed rebellion. But on January 6th of 2021, Donald Trump gave them a time and a place and a target, and they responded. They responded, and they came, and some of them were armed, and they were willing to do significant violence against the police. And, you know, they came within less than a minute, if you go through the chronology and look at where the mobs were and where members of Congress were and track them through the building. They came within about 30 yards of Mike Pence while they were yelling, "Hang Mike Pence." And they came within less than a minute of encountering the evacuating members of Congress. And I don't know what would have happened if those groups had met and physically touched, but it could have been pretty bad. So, I mean, you know, there is a lot of big talk and not action, but on the other hand, all the talk about, for example, the quote-unquote replacement theory, the idea that some malevolent force, usually described as the Jews, is importing black and brown people to replace white people in this country and to displace them in charge of society. That rhetoric has been sort of mimicked and cited by a whole bunch of mass shooters in this country in the last few years. And, you know, I mean, the march in Charlottesville, they were carrying the tiki torches and saying, "The Jews will not replace us." And it's not by coincidence. There are a lot of people who are riled up and waiting to be told where to go and on what day. And enough of them, I think, would show up if given the occasion that we have something to worry about.
In the spirit of bending over backwards to charitably construe even the fixations of neo-Nazis and white supremacists, what do you make of the work of George Soros in all of this? I mean, he's often singled out as the truly sinister and unfortunately Jewish person behind so much of what ails us on the far left side of things politically, getting DAs elected who will not prosecute crime because so much of that crime is perpetrated by non-whites, someone who's trying to erode any conception of a defensible border between nations so as to maximize the spread of immigrants and refugees without any concern for assimilation, whether that's in Western Europe and the United States. I haven't gone down this rabbit hole to see just, you know, how much is misrepresentation of what Soros and his various charities do. But insofar as I've gone down it, the man seems like a colossal idiot with respect to certain of these social problems. I mean, just speaking narrowly about the case of funding the misadventures of DAs who will not prosecute people for walking into a CVS and battering a security guard and stealing, you know, $999 worth of goods, right? I mean, it's just, it's insanity. And it's easy to see how everyone right of center has fixated upon this kind of thing as a bright, shiny object, which is synonymous with the fall of civilization. And it's the point around which they're going to organize all of their political concerns. And the only apparent answer to those concerns is Trump, given the kinds of noises that came out of the mouth of even Kamala Harris back in 2019 and 2020, when the wokeness of the Democratic Party was distorting everything. Now, you know, I find her pivot back to the center entirely credible because it's the only place of actual political sanity. But people on the right can be forgiven for thinking it's pure opportunism. This is a very long way of asking you, what, if anything, do you know about George Soros and the legitimacy of this underlying concern that there are people on the left some of whom are extraordinarily well-funded, who are basically as bad or at least confused morally and politically as they're being made out to be by the far right.
So let me try to parse this. First of all, I am very far from an expert on George Soros. Second of all, a lot of things in the MAGAverse that are attributed to or blamed on Soros, or in some cases, Bill Gates, end up being just like complete fabrications and had nothing to do with them at all. So, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who wanted to explain to me that there were, you know, there were tiny chips embedded in the COVID vaccines for mind control or to make selected populations sick or other kinds of kind of complete garbage nonsense. I have been accused online of doing Soros's bidding, and you know, I have no relationship to him. I don't think it's a coincidence that he's Jewish. And as our mutual friend David Frum has written, if you go down the rabbit hole in almost any given conspiracy theory, sooner or later you're likely to arrive at anti-Semitism.
Yeah, but it certainly doesn't help if you find an 800-pound gorilla of subversion who is actually Jewish, right? That's inconvenient, right? That, I'm not, you know, his Judaism may have absolutely nothing to do with his political convictions, and this doesn't actually cash out the intuitions of the anti-Semite. But still, if George Soros is guilty of half of what is alleged about him, shouldn't well-intentioned centrists and normal liberals disavow what he's up to? I mean, it just sounds patently insane, some of the things that's been attributed to him.
Well, I literally don't know Soros or very much about his work. I would be very surprised if half or a quarter of the things said about him were true. I might be a little bit more sympathetic than you are to the idea of prosecutorial reform, on the other hand. So I, like a lot of people, look at sort of, you know, security footage of shoplifters who, you know, punch the security guard and steal armfuls of stuff and aren't prosecuted and say that can't be right. That's a recipe for crazy social disorder. But I'm very sympathetic, for example, to reforms that say, for example, that prosecutors won't automatically seek cash bail for every case. Cash bail, as I know from covering the local courthouse at the Washington Post years ago, keeps a lot of innocent people in jail on charges that will eventually be dismissed. And the Brennan Center has done some good research that demonstrates pretty conclusively that the end of cash bail, that not incarcerating people pending trial, has not, in fact, raised the incidence of crime. So, I mean, it sounds plausible that if someone's accused of a crime and you don't keep them in jail until their trial is over, they might commit other crimes while they're out. But the data don't show that. The data show otherwise.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing is that the left got so crazy, and there are specific instances of almost any kind of misbehavior. I mean, like the worst stories, in my experience, tend to not be just pure falsehoods, right? I mean, what's more dangerous are all the half-truths out there, or the truths that can be framed in a way that is entirely misleading. But I mean, just to take, I mean, I'm sure you watched the debate between Trump and Harris, where she properly destroyed him. But in truth, you know, he destroyed himself. And there were many things he said that actually were true, but given the theater of that event, she could not acknowledge those truths and get away with it, right? So, I mean, for instance, it was true when he tried to defend himself about the from the allegation that he had said that there were good people on both sides after Charlottesville, by meaning that, you know, those neo-Nazis were carrying tiki torches were good people. That is actually just a lie that has been manufactured. If you watched that press conference and watched what he said, multiple times said, I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis. I'm not talking about the white supremacists. They should be condemned utterly, right? And he's just such a bad speaker, and he produces so much word salad that he tripped over himself. But it was his intended meaning was absolutely clear, and everyone from Joe Biden on down has lied about it for years now. So
yeah, I have to tell you, Sam, I don't see it that way. But you know, I'm not any more expert than you or anybody else is about that. But I've recently watched that clip again, and it sure looked to me like he was saying both sides.
No. But you can't watch the whole point is the clip is misleading. You have to actually watch the 10 minutes right from which the clip is taken. I mean, this is what is so toxic about social media and the clipification of everything. Anyone could be made to look like Satan. And the truth is, there's so much wrong with Trump that you never have to lie or even exaggerate what is wrong with him. But in this case, there has been a manufactured lie about what he said in that press conference. And it's a lie. It's the lie that actually Biden based his campaign on, right? I mean, he cut his first campaign ad, and he wrote an Atlantic article saying this was the moment I knew, you know, I had to run because of, you know, the basically white supremacy had come to the Oval Office. And it's actually a lie, right? So I mean, I've written an article on this, and you know, I obviously have no love for Trump, but I have love for the truth. And it's just not true what has been alleged about him. Now, I say this being fairly convinced that the guy actually is a racist, right? He's just, what he said in that press conference is just not being accurately reported. But this is all by way of saying that apparently the craziest thing he said in the debate, or at least the craziest thing in addition to the eating of cats and dogs by Haitian immigrants, when he made the allegation that Harris was in favor of taxpayer-funded gender reassignment surgery for illegal aliens in detention, or some construct of that sort, right? That's the craziest sounding utterance I think I can imagine. That actually seems to have been true, right? I mean, CNN just reported on that. I think it was Aaron Burnett just acknowledged, yeah, that actually, when given a questionnaire in 2019, she said, yeah, I'm in favor of that. That's how crazy 2019 was over in Wokistan in the Democratic Party. You know, she just smiled and looked at him like he was a madman in the debate. And that, you know, that was probably the right thing to do given the needs of the moment, because believe me, I want her to win the presidency. But the problem is, if you drill down on the concerns of many of these people who are QAnon adjacent in this fever dream of Trumpist populism, it's not all fiction. This has been a long sidebar conversation, but I just think the problem is that if you treat it as just all lies, you know, in the aftermath of the election, however it goes, my big fear is that Trumpism doesn't go away. I mean, like, is your expectation that if Trump loses narrowly, what is your expectation of Trump and Trumpism in the aftermath of a Harris victory in November?
Yeah, that's a critical question. And I don't know too much what to think about that. I have a gut feeling, and I'll just put an asterisk in before I actually say what it is. It used to be, when I was a full-time journalist, people would always ask me not what had happened, what was the real story of it, but what was going to happen. And my disclaimer is, if you can commoditize my predictions, you should go out in the market and sell them short, because I'm likely to be wrong more often than I'm right. I tend to think that if Donald Trump loses this election, that he will be the 2028 nominee, if he's still alive and kicking. I think his base is fiercely loyal. Nothing has budged it, you know, substantially. Every Republican politician is afraid of that base, and many seek to take advantage of that base by, you know, riling it up further. So, I mean, I don't see, you know, if he loses it loses narrowly, and if he does lose, he will lose narrowly. I don't see Republican Party yet ready to part with Trumpism, and there are a number of people who want to be the heirs to that throne. And, you know, the people who want to see a healthy and functioning Republican Party, because there need to be two pro-democratic parties in a constitutional democracy, have not given me a kind of substantial idea of how that happens. I mean, people say, well, the Republicans under Trump to change would have to be, you know, Trump would have to be decisively defeated, and the Republicans would have to learn that they can't win with that agenda. But if many of their adherents believe he can only lose by cheating, and if it's a question of 10,000 votes in Pennsylvania and 20,000 votes in North Carolina, then I don't know if that gets that lesson across.
Yeah. Do you think the successors to Trump just fundamentally lack the qualities, such as they are, that allow for Trumpism in the first place? I mean, can you imagine the J.D. Vances of the world actually just, you know, receiving the baton should Trump deign to pass it, or should he just expire of natural causes? And then, I mean, do you see it continuing? Or is it just the kind of thing that's likely to peter out because it just you need the personality to around which to structure the personality cult?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I believe that we could take as a starting place, we could count on that Trump will never pass the baton, just as he will never concede defeat in an election. It's completely against his MO. It's against his, frankly, his psychiatric conditions. I mean, he's not capable of conceding defeat, and he's not capable of taking himself out of the spotlight.
I mean, just to double click on the phrase psychiatric condition, I mean, watching that debate with Harris was so diagnostic of his limitations psychologically. The fact that he could not decline to take the bait when his crowd size was impugned. It's incredible. I mean, he's just, we see a man-child there who simply cannot think about anything other than himself and his fame, his wealth. I mean, it's just, he's got this, the narrowest conception of his own status, and it's, at the slightest provocation, his behavior is totally predictable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, however little debate preparation he did, and however... I mean, even if you thought his debate coaches were, you know, completely incompetent, it's inconceivable that they did not warn him.
Oh, yeah.
Don't take the bait. I mean, there's the story from his term in office as president when Russia held one of its periodic fake elections and, you know, Putin gave himself 90%+ of the vote. And Trump was going to talk to him on the phone, and they passed him a 3x5 card that said, "Do not congratulate." Right. And of course, like the first thing he said was effusive congratulations to Putin for this great electoral victory. It's the same thing. I mean, don't take the bait. I mean, it almost had giant red flashing arrows on it when Harris did it. I mean, it was a very effective strategy on her part, but it wasn't some obscure genius. It wasn't some subtle nuance. It was, here's my answer to the question, and now I'm going to give you a giant, juicy piece of bait and see if you leap for it. And just Trump just leaped for it every time.
She did it extremely well. I mean, it was much better than I was even hoping for. I mean, the most destructive thing from my point of view was just, once she got under his skin, the side-by-side shot of the two of them with him continually unraveling and even his silence just seething and waiting for the moment where he could say the next dumb thing, and his refusal to look at her, all the while on the right hand of the screen, you see her looking at him, you know, much if not most of the time, with mounting increments of disbelief and amusement, right? I mean, it was perfect. The optics of it so totally favored her. I mean, again, now I'm talking within my bubble of despising him and everything he stands for and wanting her to be president. But still, I mean, there was really nobody, I think, even on Trump's side who has said he performed well in that debate. I mean, the best they can muster is it was unfair. I mean, it was 3-1.
So now I'm speaking purely as private citizen Bart. Mm-hmm. This has nothing to do with my work, but as a kind of longtime watcher of politics and debates, I thought that Harris was exceptionally well prepared for the side-by-side visual.
Yeah.
If you had watched that debate without the sound on.
Yeah.
And this was you know, once, you know, it was Mike Deaver, Ronald Reagan's communications director, who famously said, you know, watch the event with the sound turned off and look how presidential my guy looks. And this time, I mean, Trump, who actually does have a genius for manipulating public attention and for understanding what will get attention and for understanding the medium of television, allowed the visual to get completely out of his grip. I mean, she had obviously practiced her facial expressions and was 100% conscious at all times that her reaction shot would be on the screen next to his. And he, on the other hand, looked just bitter and angry and kind of falling apart.
Yeah. So, and conversely, if you only heard the audio of the debate, I don't think you got the full measure of her victory at all. I mean, I haven't gone through the exercise of just listening to it, but I can well imagine that you might have thought the debate was somewhat close if you just heard the audio, but the visual was just devastating for him.
Yeah, they say of that Nixon lost his debate with JFK.
Just because, on television,
because it was the first televised debate and he was sweating and looked uncomfortable and JFK looked like JFK. And this one, the visuals were a big part of our victory.
I think the result is even more extreme. In the case of Nixon Kennedy, I think people who just listened to the audio think Nixon won the debate. It's that bad. Sweat is that bad. So back to the matter at hand. What do you say to somebody who is just entirely insouciant about the prospect of four more years of Trump, because they have drawn the lesson from his tenure already as president for 4 years, and they say, look, nothing bad happened. In fact, you could argue many of his policies were good. You know, he made more progress in with peace in the Middle East than anyone. We have the Abraham Accords, but based on the genius of his son-in-law, and we didn't get into any new wars. He did his best to unravel old wars, and he made a lot of noise, but all of the hysteria that he provoked, much of it has proven to be unfounded. The quote Russiagate hoax was just that, almost entirely a hoax. I mean, all of those concerns, they haven't panned out. I mean, yes, he's being prosecuted for all kinds of things, but that looks like lawfare, and it looks like the cynical weaponization of the Department of Justice against a political opponent. And if you don't buy that, he didn't become an autocrat, right? So what are you worried about?
Right. So again, a passing disclaimer, I am not telling people how to vote. And the Brennan Center's not telling people how to vote. But if you analyze the autocratic, authoritarian potential of a second Trump administration based entirely on what he says and what his closest allies want to do, then the difference a second time, according to so many people who worked for him in the administration he already had, I keep hearing people saying in his first term, and I'm unwilling to use that nomenclature because I don't want to presume the second. But first of all, there were a lot of so-called grown-ups in the room around him in the first term. He hired a lot of establishment figures. He didn't have a ready government in exile to bring with him into the presidency. And so he had people like Mattis, like Kelly, even Rex Tillerson, many others who were fundamentally inclined to be public servants, who were fundamentally bound by the rule of law, and who over and over and over again turned him away from bad ideas or simply wouldn't do them. I mean, Mark Esper tells the story in his memoir, the former defense secretary, that when there were angry demonstrations outside the White House in the last year of Trump's presidency, he turned to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, and said, can't you just shoot them? Shoot them in the legs.
Shoot them in the legs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But he said, just shoot them and then shoot them in the legs. And it wasn't the first time, because he had also proposed to shoot undocumented immigrants at the border in the legs as they tried to cross into the United States.
I just want to make a note to would-be autocrats that if your policy is to shoot people in the legs, you also hit a lot of femoral arteries and you kill a lot of people by shooting them in the legs, just so you know. It's not necessarily a minor amount of violence.
Yeah. I think I read once, nobody should take this as authoritative, but I think I read once that people bleed out from the femoral artery, as often as just about any other kind of injury to the human body, because it's a huge
a lot of blood moving through it.
But, also if there are children around, you're kind of at about at head height and so on. But the point is, it would be like wildly unlawful to use potentially lethal force on what were actually peaceful demonstrators. But even if they're not peaceful demonstrators, you can't just shoot them. But there were people who would tell him that in the first administration and tell him that on lots of other things that he wanted to do. He proposed that the IRS should audit a large number of people by name who he didn't like, and they just sort of pretended not to hear him. If he had a second shot at the presidency, there is a large group now that's been vetted by the Heritage Foundation and America First Legal and a few other organizations who are loyalists and who have some government experience and are willing to do what he tells them to do. He also didn't know the full extent of his powers as president. He knew very little, actually, about government and what it does and doesn't do. He has learned what were the kind of obstacles the first time, and has learned not to do those things or not to go to those people or to frame it in a different way. It took him, I think, 4 times to redraft the Muslim ban in such a way that the Supreme Court would swallow it. He's got people working on stuff like that this time who won't need 4 tries before they can get something accomplished. I don't believe that he could fill the government exclusively with blind loyalists for multiple reasons. No president ever has. All presidents are frustrated by the government's unresponsiveness to their desires. Many of the people who would do anything he told them don't know enough about this or that department to know where the light switches are and how to work the levers. And I think that even a Republican Senate would not confirm in office people who were too extreme or, for example, were under criminal indictment. People say, well, he'll just appoint Jeffrey Clark as his attorney general. Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the Senate would confirm Jeffrey Clark, who's been indicted in the effort to overturn the 2020 election. And he likes to appoint acting people to fill vacancies. But by law, an acting appointee has to be serving already in a Senate-confirmed position somewhere in the government, which would mean they were working for the Biden administration, or has to be, I think the proviso is, has to be a GS-13 or higher, a reasonably senior civil servant in the same department. Either way, you're not likely to get someone who will cross every red line that you set them to. So, there will be some internal resistance if Trump is elected and tries to abuse his power, but he's going to be a more effective autocrat than he was last time.
And what do we know about Project 2025?
Well, it's interesting because there's the public document, which is, filled with things that you could decide yourself whether you like them as policy, but in some cases which are designed to give unaccountable power to the president and the presidency. So, the whole idea that you should make tens of thousands of career civil service jobs political appointees who are loyal to the president and not to the law and the rules and regulations and precedents that govern their departments, that you want to have people deciding whether medicine is safe or water is clean or labor laws are being followed. You know, you want political appointees to be in charge of all those things, you know, down at the level of the civil service. You know, that's to basically remove constraints from the president. The idea that there should be no such thing as a quasi-independent agency, that the idea that the president doesn't automatically just give orders to the IRS or the FDA or the FEC, or there are several dozen of these independent agencies, that Project 2025 wants to put all under the direct personal control of the president.
What do you think is motivating the people at Heritage or any other organization that, that seems to have been captured by Trumpism? Because in a previous age of the Republican Party, these are precisely the kinds of things that would have worried them, right? I mean, they don't want President Obama to have these kinds of powers.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, they've just gone full MAGA. I mean, let me take a small example that relates to something we talked about earlier. So this allegation that we have a national epidemic of non-citizen voting. The Heritage Foundation recently published a report saying that an estimated 14% of voters were undocumented immigrants, were non-citizens. And they got this by going around representing themselves as a kind of pro-Latino voting assistance organization. And they went around and did interviews in Hispanic neighborhoods in which they got people who might or might not have fully understood what they were asking to say, in seven cases, a grand total of seven times, they got someone to say that they were not a citizen and that they were registered to vote. It turns out the New York Times investigated this and found that, in fact, they weren't registered to vote. But from a sample of seven people, the Heritage Foundation projected that 14% of all registered voters were non-citizens. I mean, they're doing work that's as preposterous as that now. And they used to be an absolutely respectable intellectual. They were conservative, but they believed in empirical standards and had legitimate academics and believed in the use of evidence. And that's just gone.
Amazing. So, Bart, is there anything we haven't touched on that is of real concern to you on this topic? Is there anything we haven't covered?
Well, I want to say maybe a few words about how people who believe in the rule of law and believe in democracy should respond if Trump is elected and if an authoritarian is elected.
Great.
So, you know, a lot of people have heard conversations like this, but for my own part, I have friends and associates who tell me, well, you know, if Trump wins, I'm leaving the country. And, you know, so on and so forth. They have people say, well, you know, I know people who work in civil rights organizations who say they just can't imagine doing that in the environment of an authoritarian president. And I was talking to one well-known pro-democracy litigator. I mean, wouldn't be known to every one of your listeners, but if you ask people who know the space of sort of civil rights and political rights litigators, the name would be very familiar. And she was late for a Zoom meeting I had with her some months ago, and she said, "Sorry, I was, you know, working out the logistics of my move." And I said, "Move?" And she said, she gave me a specific location where she would go if Trump were elected. And I said, "Wait a minute, you can't leave. You're the one we need if we have an abusive president, a law-breaking president. You're the one who's got to help us fight abuse of power." And she said, "You know, I'm on a list. You know, I'm on a MAGA list of targets. If Trump gets back in office, I'm not going to waste years of my life fighting a made-up criminal charges." And now it's easy for me to say, but, you know, in my view, if he wins and tries to do the abusive things he's said he's going to do, the slogan's got to be stay and fight, we have more people in this country who believe in democracy and believe in the rule of law than people who don't. And ultimately, the final check against authoritarian abuse of power is public opinion, is the American people writ large, and all the people whose work has been to protect democratic institutions have to redouble that work if it comes under fire. And Americans who think it doesn't matter to them had better take a closer look and look more concretely at what's happening and decide whether they don't have a stake in our constitutional form of government, because they do.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a phrase from Timothy Snyder that was echoing in my ear as you were talking, which was, don't obey in advance.
Yes, exactly. It's his, he think he has, what, 20 rules, and that was the first one.
Yeah. Yeah.
For how to respond to a
tyranny,
dictator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Bart, thanks as always for your contributions to this space. We're definitely better informed and more alert for everything you've done for many years now. And I'm very happy you're actually trying to put your hands on the machinery at this point. So thanks again.
Well, I listen to you regularly, and I almost always find something new. You have a very interesting way of crossing kind of, tired ideological lines and finding something to say that I hadn't expected. So I really appreciate having a chance to be on your show and to talk to your listeners.
Nice. Happy to hear it.